says you gotta come in before dark.
Okay, coming.
It's time.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat.
Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
Welcome to Behind the Panels, issue 102, the comic book show that wishes it was in San Diego right now. I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
I'm David Longo.
In this issue, Comixology releases its comics from the shackles of digital rights management, and there was much rejoicing. Then Ultron gets angrier, Tyler Durden is back, lots more Guardians into the Galaxy on the way, and Saga wins everything at the Eisners. Also, Gru gets incredibly meta, Year Zero finally ends, and the Doctor regenerates into a comic book character in what we've been reading. Plus, our Kick-Ass Pick of the Week, Lock and Key. Welcome to Lovecraft by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. This is Behind the Panels. No one wants to make a terrible choice. I'm the price of being free. I don't want to face the killer instinct. Face it in you or me. So we keep it on lock and key. Lock and key. Yes, that was Lock and Key by Canadian progressive rock group Rush.
Why did you pick that song?
I don't know now that I come to think of it. Look, mentioned at the top of the show, San Diego Comic-Con is on right now, so I literally rewrote the entire show notes this morning.
Well, there's a lot of announcements this morning.
Yeah, the news that came out. So look, you know, this is the time. It's a great thing that we're recording this on Sunday afternoon in Australia because all the big announcements have been made now. So we'll talk about those later when we get to the news headlines. But there's quite a few. There's some of the things that we won't talk about then, but like photos and things have come out. Like that.
All
big...
I'm going to say is Wonder Woman.
Yeah, Wonder Woman. You know, actually speaking of that, here's a quick message from our sponsors.
Now we'll finish that spinning pencil top. That's it. You cut out a cardboard disc. Now make any design on it you'd like using crayons or felt tip markers.
How's that?
Fine. Now, take a short lead pencil and push it through the very center of the disc. Okay, give it a spin.
Hey, when you spin it on a piece of paper and mix designs.
That's a pencil top.
Fun! Thanks, Wonder Woman.
As presented by Zack Snyder. So,
and that's actually a scene from the new film.
That's
straight, what they showed at Comic-Con.
That's straight from Comic-Con. Imagine they did that. They go, exclusive footage, and they play like... You know,
it's going to be like with that
bomb, bomb, bomb. You've got yourself a spinning top.
I feel a mashup coming on.
Oh, that's YouTube
gold. We
need
that with Hans Zimmer music.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
That's how Wonder Woman is named. The little kid's like,
you're a real Wonder Woman.
It's all set in the 70s. You're a real Wonder Woman.
Did you say 70s? That's enough of that.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, long story short, we actually got a look at Wonder Woman's costume and all those complaints about Gal Gadot online have just disappeared suddenly.
Gone.
I saw one, it was like, she's going to really have to beef up those legs. And I think, oh, for God's sake.
Oh, stop it.
Let it go. So the thing, but someone else rightly pointed out, Batman and Superman, Henry Cavill and what's his name? Ben Affleck.
Batfleck.
You know, like, yeah, they beefed up. They've also got suits that like kind of, you know.
I like Kevin Smith was trying to say, no, that's really Ben Affleck under that costume. He's really beefed. I was like, now we've seen the costume without him in it, and it's still got all the same muscles.
But he needs to buff up to match the costume, because there's going to be one scene where he's got a shirt off.
Seriously though, the Superman costume was the, it's actually digitally contoured to his body, so he said he couldn't gain or lose an inch.
Yeah, they
between the time
making,
they did
yeah.
that. Yeah.
It's like the embedded Apple logo in the phone. It's like they've tattooed that on his chest.
But that was like Tobey Maguire's spider suit was the same because Tobey Maguire was cut.
Because he was
a yogi and all this sort of stuff, and he was really cut. So when they did the costume, they actually enhanced what was already there. But literally, it was form factored to his body.
Look, the thing is. It's from what we've seen so far. I might have to eat my words on snack.
I'm not going that far.
No,
yet.
But we've barely seen anything. There's a bit of loot.
What we have is a very, very successful costume designer at this point.
We've seen a bit of loot footage, and it looks kind of good. Beyond that, there was a bit of stuff leaked from Age of Ultron. There was a massive Age of Ultron poster art thing that went up this week,
brilliant.
Which is beautiful, which shows the Avengers plus Vision plus Quicksilver plus Scarlet Witch fighting all
these
Ultron
robots. I think my favorite
thing,
though, was the fans filling in the panels with their own scratches.
Yeah. That was brilliant. I love that.
It's like, here it is. It's finished. It's like pencil scratchings of
We
Thor.
Had a couple suggestions, didn't we, Richard?
Yeah.
I think Thor should... I quite frankly think Thor should have been a frog in it, but that's beside the point.
Yeah. Or a woman.
Or a woman. Yeah.
Actually, he addressed it in the panel. He apparently came out and said, you know, is there anything you'd like to see Thor do? And he said, yeah, I think Thor should be a woman. He said, if I got to play him, Oscar bait for sure.
Could Chris Hemsworth grow breasts? This is the question.
I reckon I think he has got breasts.
They should just
point.
Swap over, get Evans to play Chris Evans, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
sorry, get
you know,
Chris Evans to play Chris Evans.
Yeah,
that's
Hemsworth.
A good idea.
They're both called Chris. There you go. Yeah, Chris Hemsworth to swap roles with Chris Evans.
And no one would notice.
Yeah.
The suits are all form factor.
No one noticed. Yeah. So, something looks different about that. Let's let it go. Well, speaking of meta, let's get into what we've been reading, because one of the first books we're reading is incredibly meta.
Oh,
this
man.
Week.
What a book.
Where? Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Read between the lines, bitch.
That book, of course, is Gru versus Conan.
It makes me laugh just thinking about it.
Gru versus Conan, Dawn of Justice. No, Gru versus Conan is a Dark Horse crossover between Conan the Barbarian
and Gru the Wanderer.
And Gru the Wanderer. Written by Sergio Aragonés, who did the classic. And basically the story, because you'd read it before I had, David, and it starts off as a classic Conan book, and then Gru comes into it, and then suddenly it's Sergio Aragonés and his agent.
It's like one of those classic comedy moments where suddenly the needle scratch goes and we cut to the real world, although drawn by...
That would never work.
Yeah,
you know?
He's going, I don't want to do this crossover.
And then there's a protest in front of a comic store, and then he's in hospital, and Sergio thinks that he's Gru, or I think thinks that he's Conan, and then they go into the Conan world again. But no, they go into the Gru world, and Gru's defending a bakery as if it was the comic book store. Oh, someone's got a message.
Yeah.
So it's an odd little book, and I didn't dislike it, but it's not what I was expecting at all.
I actually thought it was very funny. It's very Sergio Aragonés. If you are a fan of Gru the Wanderer, at this point, the book is mostly Sergio Aragonés. Mm. Conan has a small but brief cameo at the beginning and then a small but brief cameo at the end. The next issue looks like it's going to be more Conan-based, but I think we're still having this meta crossover with the real world. If you would admire his sense of humor from things like Mad Magazine and, of course, Gru the Wanderer
itself. They mention Mad Magazine.
They do it. At one point, they said nothing's more dangerous than a Mad Magazine cartoonist. it is actually quite funny. And, of course, one of the funniest things about Gru the Wanderer is still in this, which is the asides from people who know him, because Gru's a moron. And so in this, we've got his dog following him around.
Yeah.
Whatever his name is. Anyway, basically, and his thought bubbles are all like, oh, my God.
And has his own little comic at the very end.
Yes, his last little page. It's a funny book. I don't know if it's... I think this book is 30 years too late, quite frankly. It should have come out when Gru was at its height in the mid-80s.
Yeah, back when there was I think Gru actually was one of the Marvel graphic novels.
It was actually a Marvel original series.
Yeah, that's right.
And it then was picked up by other companies after that as well. And I have Jake, who used to co-host Geek Actually way back in the early days, he was a massive Gru fan. And we were collecting Gru from issue one, and we thought this was the funniest thing we'd ever read. And I just feel like this book's just a little bit too late. It's good. I liked it. It's just I felt like a little too late.
Speaking of books that are a little bit too late, Batman number 33 came out this week. I've always made you spit your tea up, didn't I?
I noticed that too.
This is the final chapter of Year Zero. And boy, did I. I mean, look, this is... Honestly, at the end, I was just saying to Dave before the show, I can't remember how it ended. It's inconsequential because, like, we're going to move on. There's going to be, like, a break issue and then we're into another saga of some kind. Mm. And then that's...
Well, this is how Snyder is writing, though, isn't he? He's writing event by event.
And just, so. I'm just putting up a random page. The sheer amount of text on this thing still. It's kind of like he still had that much to say by the end of it. Look, it basically comes down to Batman having to riddle his way out of a room. But then he doesn't really do that. At one point, he just goes, you know what? I don't have to do this.
You know? I love that. Yeah, right.
And then off he goes, and he just punches out the Riddler. And then it's just then there's an ending where it's like a conversation between him and Alfred, basically saying, "You know, Alfred, I'm just going to keep doing this." And it's almost a conversation with the audience. It's almost like, you know, Snyder's turned to the audience and says, "You know what? I'm going to keep writing this the way I want to do it. Yeah. I don't care what you say." And it was a frustrating year, and it's come to an end now. And I'm glad, because I want to see some forward momentum in this book, because it was the best book in the new 50, the newish 46.
Yeah. They still have New 52 on the cover.
Yeah,
still.
Yeah, no, they're still carrying, but they don't have.
I counted books. The October solicitations, and if you're really generous, including some of the weeklies, it's about 45, 46. So go figure.
I got to throw out though another new book, which also is text heavy though, was the new Superman.
It was, yeah.
Yeah,
John's he's got speech bubbles everywhere too.
It's a damn good issue.
It is. No, don't get me wrong. I liked it.
And there's not much to add from what we said last time. It's a continuation of that story. It's a classic Superman story.
But it stayed strong. So what's happened with a lot of the DC books that I've noticed is that the number one comes out and you go, yeah, this isn't bad. We've made a new take on this or whatever it is. And then it just goes steadily downhill. This is held. This is actually as strong as the first issue of the Romita Johns collection. So we'll see what happens with it.
But of course, the other new DC book that came out this week was Star Spangled War Stories, another attempt at a war book. This one was a little bit different because it was G.I. Zombie.
And I have to say, Palmiotti doesn't fail to pay off in this.
Yeah, look, it's Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray, who were a bit of a power team. And I quite enjoyed it.
So did I.
Yeah, I didn't expect. I sort of looked at the cover and thought, here we go.
And my favorite part of this book is actually the first half of the book. So, because it starts with some chick showing up at a biker bar, and she's tough as nails, and they're all going, who is she, what is she? And some of the stuff she says is just outrageous.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they bring in a fed. They're saying he's clean, we've checked him and all this sort of stuff. And they're saying, what do we do about her? And maybe she works with him. And she goes about and then basically tortures him. And it's brutal.
It is brutal.
Just like brutal.
And the way they do it, because they use, you don't know that.
No.
Apart from the title of the book, you don't know that this guy is a zombie at this point.
Well, we don't know he's a zombie at the moment because we haven't introduced him.
So she just takes apart this guy, and then there's a reveal, and you're like, oh, that's what they could do with this book. That's actually kind of interesting.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then what I think the part about this book that I liked the most was the fact that you think, okay, so he's a zombie with a heart of gold. This is going to be real. This is going to get tiresome real fast.
Yeah.
But then he has to go and feed.
Yes.
And I thought that was actually a really interesting scene because I love that line where he actually turns to the survivor and says, I can't stop. Leave now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of... So there's your major character frailty for the book. We've actually set up a really interesting take on... It's not really, though, a war story in that sense. But
aside the fact that he's a soldier.
Although I get the fact that because this one's called Star Spangled War Stories, G.I. Zombie, I wonder if it's going to be a little bit like the DC Presents or whatever it was.
That's my
exact
thought.
So after six issues or something, we'll get a different war story.
And it'll probably sink the comic book. So we'll see what happens. This will be like Dead Man. It'll be a really good start.
And then somebody else will come in and it'll be something
else. By the way, I have a correction to myself. The dog's name was Rufaretto.
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 Of course it was.
Of course it was.
Or is it Rufaretto?
Rufaretto. I have one question for you about the G.I. Zombie.
Yeah.
When he takes
Flavin.
What is it they hit? the deer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When
they
hit the deer and he says, I'm going to take it back to its mother. Did he go eat it or did he actually take it back to a mother? What do you think happened there?
In retrospect, he probably ate it.
I think he ate it too. I think he was just hiding it from her.
At the time, I think that I actually thought he was taking it back to his mother. But then given how the issue ended,
it actually made me think about it afterwards. And I'm sitting there going, he went to have a snack.
not to be confused with the snack we were mentioning before, which was Zack Snyder.
Yes.
Ragnarok. Ragnarsnack. Ragnarok. Ragnarok, I should say, not Ragnarok. Which is, of course, the end of everything.
Which apparently the Thor comics have had about five times.
Had quite a few times.
Well, this feels like they didn't have the rights to those comics.
Yeah, well, this is Walt Simonson's book. It didn't make a huge impact on me, I got to say. Like,
no,
it was interesting. Like the characters that they're playing with are things that I'm interested in because I like all that Norse mythology, but just didn't do a lot. This is, you know, I mean, Walt Simonson, no slouch.
And no stranger to that world.
And no stranger to that world, because he wrote the classic Thor stuff. Yeah. It's kind of almost as a Thor story he wanted to tell, but as you said, he's not writing for Marvel at the moment, so he's doing this instead. Yeah, it did make a huge impact on me. The other one, which is really weird mashup, was Transformers versus G.I. Joe.
Oh my God.
Dave's favorite comic of the week.
So just to give you some context, dear listeners, it was drawn and written as like an old four-color comic that you would have found with like a G.I. Joe.
Yeah, it looked like it came out comic, straight out of the 70s toy. Or early 80s. And what I also really liked was that it obviously looked like a tie-in, so all of the art is drawn so that the positions that the characters hold and stuff actually look like they're action figures, you know, so they're kind of this stilted. I loved my favorite character in it though was I loved the general, because he spent the entire issue, every time you saw him, his hat was like offset.
I mean, I kind of admired that they were doing something a little bit different to what most IDW crossovers do.
It didn't look like an IDW book, and we'll come back to that
later. Yeah, which didn't just throw in the two characters and assume that it would work out in the wash. They were really taking the piss with this one, but it didn't quite
didn't set me on fire.
The other book that did sort of set me on fire but didn't got off to a slow start for me but then really lit up my fire was Supreme Blue Rose number one, which was Warren Ellis. Mm-hmm. This is the Supreme character, which was created by Rob Liefeld for Image back in 1992, but it's had some amazing writers on it over the years. It's I mean, Alan Moore did a Supreme run. Alan Moore's Supreme. Because apparently Rob Liefeld asked Alan Moore if he could write further adventures of Supreme afterwards. But this is, if Supreme was an analog for Superman, this Blue Rose concentrates on
the Lois
Lane character, and it starts off with this really weird metaphysical, this is the only island reality left and everything else is fake, and you're thinking, what the hell have I wandered into? And then it comes back to reality, and she like literally to get best Instagram ever, takes a photo, and which is just such a great line to introduce a character with. And then it becomes her investigating. The Blue Rose is referring to something that doesn't exist in nature.
But what's really interesting though is that the artwork, even once we hit the real world, is still almost surrealistic. It's got this kind of weird lines and
there's the scribbles that run through the whole page.
Yeah, so it almost feels like it's kind of like out of sync with the rest of the world. It's an odd book. It's an odd duck, this one.
That's kind
of
cool.
It's a beautiful book.
But it's a beautiful book. And what's really interesting is if you read the notes at the end of the book about the art, it's actually transitioning because he started in pen and ink.
Yeah.
And the end of the book is actually digital art and digital lines. So he said, and he had to make the transition as seamless as possible because he's moving into digital art. So it's really, and he's got samples of like, before and after.
There's a thing where it was like, you know, there are things in this world you don't realize unless you're looking for it. And then when you read the issue back, it's like the whole thing is covered in in these scratches. Yeah.
There's also a line early in the comic where he says something along the lines of, or she in her narration says, it's almost like a world that hasn't been finished yet.
Yeah.
And
that's kind of how the art feels.
That's how the art feels, and that's how I felt when I first started reading the book. I thought, oh, I don't think this idea is finished yet. And then there's that sudden tone shift, and you think, oh, that's what this is about. Mm. You know, this is something entirely different. So,
and why you've still got this dreamlike quality to it, though, is because even after she's in the real world, she meets that guy.
Yeah, but they've already established at that stage that everything in the real world is not what you think it is.
And his face is all blurred. And he goes, it's a birth defect.
Yeah. And you're the only one who can see, you know, you're one of the few people who can see it. I mean, we should point out that Warren Ellis has another book out this week as well, which is Trees, number three. Look, I got to say, I hope Blue Rose maintains the quality that the first issue promised, because the first issue of Trees was really good, but then it's kind of lost me a little bit since then. So I'm hoping he can maintain the quality of this first issue of Supreme Blue Rose. But, of course, something that has maintained its quality forever is Saga number 21 came out this week. And, God. It is brilliant. I mean, look, we'll talk about it in a minute. Saga's just taken out a bunch of Eisner Awards, and it should until it finishes its run. Like, it's going
to
always be.
I'd like to point out they've also managed to, over 21 issues, make Alana hotter.
Well, she's running around.
I've actually fallen in love with this character.
She's running around in her underwear, basically. Yeah. She's on the circuit. doing this combat, and they're basically an acting slash combat slash product placement model, which is this weird thing.
I love that line though, when they're taking the drugs and she goes, "This is the beginning of every of every cautionary tale you've ever heard."
Yeah, this thing, they've got that happening. Like she's obviously, that's going to be, I mean, but knowing Vaughn, it probably won't quite go where we think it's going to go. You know, Marco almost has an affair, but then she comes home and she's like, "I want you now."
Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, where it goes. And it's kind of, you can still see how much these two love each other, but the world is slowly pushing them apart.
And we know it's going to push apart because of the narration of Hazel.
Hazel, a few issues. Issues. This is the, you know, this is the start of my parents breaking up, was a couple of issues ago. So it's, the parallel story that's running with Prince Robot, and that final page.
Yes, yeah.
Who, and you know, it's a character who hasn't been mentioned before, but you kind of think, oh yeah, of course, that character must exist somewhere in this world. And you think, so we're going to meet that character shortly, which is going to be awesome. No spoilers, because the final page of every issue of Saga is the greatest thing you've ever read until the next issue.
So Saga won Eisner's, right?
Saga won best continuing series.
Yes.
Because it is the best continuing series.
By far.
Ever, you know.
I got to say, though, it's not just the last page that is shocking.
The whole
issue. It's the last three pages, though. It's from when we come back to Prince Robot on the Pleasure Planet. And I love the fact that he's...
Is it still Sextillion?
Sextillion.
Yes. We must sound crazy to people that haven't read this book.
all I'm going to say is, if you haven't read this book, go read this book.
There are currently three trade paperbacks. Go and buy them all at once.
It's a blind buy.
Because as soon as you finish the first one, you're going to want to read the next two. So.
Yeah. I love the fact that Prince Robot is slowly losing his mind, and he actually has the crack across his screen. So you've got this symbolism. It's very good.
Because he's been there for, like, we don't know how long he's been there
for. A few months, by the sounds of it.
A few months, because someone says to him, how long ago was this news of his child's birth? That's something weird. It's not a spoiler. It's like, and they said 21 days, and he reacts badly to that.
Poorly.
He reacts poorly to that. interesting thing from Marvel out this week, a couple of books. We'll run through the next ones quickly. Storm number one came out this week. So this is a new standalone Storm book. This is obviously part of Marvel's conscious effort to have more female-led books.
And many more X-Men titles.
It's an odd bird, because it's not a bad book at all. But Storm is already a leader in her own in another book, which is X-Men, the one that Brian Wood started, which is a very female-led book, because it's an all-female team, ironically named X-Men, which is a very strong book. This feels like it could have been an issue of that series, because and the weird thing is, too, it doesn't even set up any stories as an ongoing. It feels like a one-shot, because the story that introduces this is tied up by the final page, and there's not even any lingering threads of, like, things to come.
Can I tell you, though, I think it would actually be quite refreshing, and I don't know, you guys can chime in, but I think it might be quite refreshing, because I really like this book, and I think it would be quite refreshing to have a series of books where each issue is self-contained, finished, and done.
I agree, because I think it's something that's missing from modern comics, that everything is setting up the next six issues.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we'll talk about Daredevil in a moment, and that's setting up an arc. But that's what I like about Daredevil. I like that it's thinking 10 steps ahead. But that was a classic comics thing. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, not so much in the 80s, they're starting to build arcs. Yeah. But before that, it was like you pick up that issue, and like every issue was somebody's first issue.
And it said to be continued was actually kind of a big thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't the regular
thing. Oh, this story's too big for this one issue. Yeah. Wow.
And that only really continued for like two or three issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Days of Future Past, two issues.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Spider-Man arcs were only two or three issues.
Think about that. One of the greatest X-Men stories of all time was told in two issues. So
Phoenix Saga is only five or something like that. It's literally she becomes Phoenix, she goes a bit crazy, and it's over.
Yeah.
It's literally over really fast.
And this was in a period like Claremont wrote 17 years worth of X-Men comics, and yet his best stories are told in two or three issues.
Yeah, so, and they're all told early in the arc.
Yeah.
I mean, all this classic stuff, Days of Future Past, this is all in the first three or four years of his run. You know,
the only thing that expanded out longer than that was God Loves, Man Kills, which was a graphic novel, you know, which is effectively the equivalent of two or three issues anyway.
Correct.
So anyway, so Daredevil number six came out. This was a Original Sin tie-in issue. And so some stuff about Matt Murdock's dad has been revealed, and he goes back to find his mum, and she's in a bit of strife, and he's off to Wakanda. So it's that's all I'm going to say about this issue because it is a really good.
Like, can I just take a second to praise the cover art again for Daredevil? I just there's something about the cover art for that book that is just.
Because it's still Chris, because Javier Rodriguez does the interiors this issue, but Chris Somni does the cover.
Yeah,
and it's just phenomenal.
They're always so creative and strange.
Because they're not, they don't like directly. They directly tie to the story, in that it's symbolically representing what's happening in the story. So it's not just a pretty cover for the sake of having a pretty cover, but it is still something that, as you say, can stand alone as its own piece of art.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I look, that's a book that if it ever ends. I will weep. I will openly
weep.
Well,
it did end and we weeped.
But we knew it,
we knew it
was coming.
We wept, but it came back.
Two wibbly-wobbly books I will talk about very quickly first of all, the Doctor Who, the 10th Doctor number 1 came out from Titan. Good issue. It's set basically after the fourth season of the 10th Doctor. So if you know that show, it's after he has to leave Donna. Behind, and so he picks up with him alone again looking for a companion, and he finds a companion in New York. So it's he has an American companion in this one, and it's an interesting story. It's written well. It perfectly captures the speech patterns of the Doctor, Tennant, of the 10th Doctor, of Tennant. So you kind of got these bits where he's sort of talking, and then he sort of talks, he goes, did I do that? Maybe I did that. Do I know the Prince of Belgium? Is there a Prince of Belgium? Well, it could be, you know, that kind of stuff. And so it captures that really well. And so I quite liked it. It was an enjoyable read. I think that the 11th Doctor one by Al Ewing is a little bit better because it is even more on target with what Matt Smith was like. And maybe it's because Matt Smith's not more fresh in my mind because I'm actually watching all the Tennant episodes at the moment in a revival that I'm in, part of my marathon that I'm doing. But Matt Smith had sort of captured it perfectly. They've got a British companion instead of an American one, so it kind of feels a bit more like the classic Doctor Who. You know, like Doctor Who that we know, current...
Let me ask you a question. I've never been a Doctor Who comic reader.
Nor have I, actually.
Because I don't know. The whole tie-in thing doesn't work for me. It's like I've never been a Transformers reader and, you know, what happened. Yeah. My question is, are these two books the books to bring me into it?
They might be, actually, because they're very... Because they're with the newer Doctors... So there's a modern sensibility to them. I think the problems with the other ones are they always felt a little bit hokey.
I always kind of felt with the Doctor Who tie-ins that they felt kind of like cash-in.
They do feel like these ones, because they've got some decent writers and decent artists on them, it feels a little bit better. It's a little bit stronger of a title.
Okay,
I may not last with them, but I'm such a Doctor Who obsessive at the moment. I'm reading everything.
It's kind of like I kind of fell off the bandwagon with the Star Wars tie-ins and stuff as well.
I may not read them, but I thought, like, you know, we're doing a weekly comic show, a new Doctor Who book out this week. I better read it.
Why not?
So, quickly next week, some of the highlights that are coming out. There's a new book from Dark Horse. These are the books that are coming out on the 30th of July. So there's a new book from Dark Horse called Deep Gravity number 1. A new series which I'm looking forward to from Vertigo called Bodies, which looks interesting. Justice League number 32. Justice League's been on fire lately. So
I always love a good Justice League.
Looking forward to that. Finally, Sandman Overture number 3 is coming out. I'm going to have to go back and read the first two because I remember having to read the first one again when the second one came out. So I couldn't remember.
I don't remember the first one now.
No.
That's the problem.
The book that I want to mention, Vertigo Quarterly Magenta. I can't believe it's been 3 months since the last Vertigo Quarterly came out. I want to give a shout out to Vertigo Quarterly Magenta. Go and grab a copy because our good friend Ryan K. Lindsay has got a story in there.
Oh,
it's a massive coup for him. And I actually saw, I think back at Supernova, he was showing me a bit of the art when I met him at his table, and it looks amazing. So go and check that out. Ryan's written it. So I can't say enough good things about his writing. So go and check that out. And it's a good anthology book, full stop. Mm. You know, Dark Horse Presents wins the the Eisner for best anthology every year. This one will give it a run for its money, I reckon. Scott Snyder's Wake finishes next week. Number 10 comes out.
I can finally go back and start finishing.
Yeah, me too. The trade will be out shortly after.
I purposely stopped reading them because
same here.
It was too long between drinks and I was really enjoying it. So I thought I'm going to stop. And when it's number 10, I'm just going to guts it down.
Well, it's finally done. But
I felt the same way about Trillium.
Well, the great thing
now
about
Trillium's come out.
Sean Murphy's got another project coming up, which we'll talk about in the news headlines, called Image. So that's looking good as well. Speaking of Image, Rick Remender. Does he write everything at the moment?
At the moment, he does.
He's got, because there's another announcement in the news as well, Low number one. There's a lot of buzz around this book, so definitely that's one to read for next week. Something called Iron Man Special out next week. I didn't investigate it as well, but I always put
this
any number
one
ones.
Of the 100th anniversary
no,
ones,
it's
it?
Not.
No? Okay.
They're weird. I don't know what they're about.
I had a look at it. I finally figured what that is. Went and looked it up. I had to go look it up.
Is it like the DC 1 million thing?
Yeah. So basically what it is Marvel has decided to say, at our 100th anniversary, this is where the comics will be. And so each one, like when you pick up the X-Men one, it actually says issue 8 of 8. And you go, wait a minute. But there is no other issues. It's like you're literally coming in in the middle of a story, you know?
It's an odd one.
It's kind of a clever idea, and each one is its own standalone thing. And it's like, this is maybe where we'll be in a few years, you know?
The only other book I mentioned that's coming out next week is Hawkeye number 19, only because it's in a brilliant book. And I think Dave was saying it's like the second issue to come out this year. It doesn't seem like we've had a lot. We're up to July and there's been a few months missing, but it's coming to an end soon. Like 22, I think, is the last issue.
I look forward to Hawkeye every time though. So
very, very much, because I don't want to spoil next week's show when we'll be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy will be our feature. The film will be our feature title, but Dave and I saw it this week. My review's up on behindthepanels.net, so you can tell my thoughts from that. To quote Archer, sploosh. this was the best, not the best Marvel film, the best film I've seen ever, full stop. It's just like it is like watching
ever. A big call.
It's like watching, I think you said it best, Dave, it's like watching Star Wars and Raiders of the Ark for the first time together, you know.
I have nothing really to say.
No,
I'll give my brother's review of Guardians, because my brother came with me to watch it. His review was, they nailed it. 100%. 100% nailed it.
Yep. That's all we're going to say until next week. So tune in when we've all had a chance to see it.
Friday.
Yeah. Can't wait. So.
Well, like, what's the point of spewing hyperbole now, hey?
Yeah, exactly right. So I think that's a really good time to move on to the news headlines. What do you reckon, David?
Sounds good to me.
And Marvel Studios has announced that a Guardians of the Galaxy sequel is bound for cinemas on the 28th of July, 2017. Yes! It will be directed by and written by James Gunn.
They also confirmed that Corey Stoll will join Ant-Man as Yellowjacket and Evangeline Lilly as Hope Van Dyne.
The 2014 Eisner Awards have been announced, with Saga once again a clear leader, taking out awards for Best Continuing Series, with Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples also honoured. Sex Criminals was named Best New Series, and Australia's All-Star Comics in Melbourne took out a well-deserved Spirit of Retailing Award.
Marvel will begin releasing Star Wars comics from January 2015, set during the original trilogy. Creators include, are you ready, Jason Aaron, Kieran Gillen, Mark Waid, John Cassaday, Salvador LaRocca, and Terry Dodson.
Holy hell. Image Comics has announced 12 new titles at the Image Expo and Comic-Con, including the highly anticipated Tokyo Ghosts from... You guessed it, Rick Remender, Sean Murphy and Matt Hollingsworth. Other major Image announcements include Kurt Busiek's Tooth and Claw, Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen's Descender, and Becky Cloonan's Southern Cross.
Marvel has announced a new original graphic novel, Avengers
Rage of Ultron,
for April 2015, from Rick, wait a minute, Remender? and Jerome Opina.
Comixology has announced that they will include DRM-free backups, both PDF and CBZ files, of the comics purchased from them. Image Comics, Dynamite Entertainment, Monkey Brain Comics, Thrill Bent, Top Shelf Productions, and Zenoscope Entertainment have all opted into the program so far.
Cool. I apologize in advance. Chuck Palahniuk?
Palahniuk.
And Cameron Stewart will create Fight Club 2 for Dark Horse as a 10-issue miniseries from April 2015.
I want you to read me as hard as you can. IDW has secured the license to publish a series of comics based on the BBC America TV series Orphan Black.
Sony has set aside 11th of November 2016 for Sinister Six and pegged The Amazing Spider-Man 3 for 2018.
Oh, joy. American Mary directors Jen and Sylvia Soska have been tapped to helm the big screen adaptation of Painkiller Jane.
Excellent. Marvel and Disney XD are bringing a Guardians of the Galaxy animated series to TV in the very new future. Of course they are.
It's just sploosh. And finally, Universal Cable Productions has announced deals with Warren Ellis, Rick Remender, and Frank J. Barbier to adapt Nightmare, Five Ghosts, and an original series by Ellis to TV.
I'd like to point out that Rick Remender's name was in the news so much that our music ran out.
Yeah. It's hard to say Rick Remender quickly as well.
But you will remember his name. Oh, sorry.
Look, we won't get into it. Look, there's heaps to talk about. Mm. We'll probably talk a little bit about over it on the film show, but I guess the big news out of Comic-Con was that the Marvel stuff wasn't quite as exciting as we thought it was going to be.
No.
Really, we just got a Guardians 2 confirmed, which is pretty exciting, but we didn't get the announcements of Doctor Strange and new movie titles, those six titles.
We did have Josh Brolin walk out on stage with an Infinity Gauntlet.
That's true. That's
true. So that was pretty, that was like an inside joke from them, but that was kind of saying, it's coming, pals.
Don't you worry, it's coming. Speaking of things that are coming, we're 35 minutes into this show, so I think it's time for our kick-ass pick of the week.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
Still reeling from the tragic and violent death of a loved one, the Locke family moved to the New England mansion at Key House. No ordinary house. It contained doorways that once entered, transformed those who walked through them. Yet they have also awakened something dark and angry. Written by best-selling author Joe Hill with art from Gabriel Rodriguez, this is a modern dose of gothic horror. This is Lock and Key. Some doors aren't meant to be opened.
And there's that voice again.
There it is. And we should hire him more.
We should.
That guy.
I think we should put him on the payroll.
Yes, he would like to be paid. This is a book, one of those books I've been meaning to get around for years. And there's not as many of them as I thought there were. And I thought it was like too big tackle. But there's six, were you saying, Dave? There's six.
They just finished one as well. They just finished Omega.
I think I'm not 100% on it, but I'm pretty sure he wrapped up the story.
Yeah, I think Omega is in.
I'm not sure.
There's an Alpha and an Omega.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole bunch of others.
I think because a friend of mine is really obsessed with Lock and Key. And I think that there's talk of Joe Hill doing a prequel thing or something.
Right, right.
But the main storyline is wrapped.
Yeah, my understanding was that Omega finishes it. And it is done now. Yeah. So, but yeah, there's like six major series. But the thing is, each series is only like six issues. So it's not actually that big a thing to deal with. Each series is
one trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not that big a deal to get through them.
So the thing is, I mean, and it's not really a big deal to get through them because the story itself is really, really intriguing and it really sort of sucks you in. Mm. It's that classic kind of thriller suspense thing. And it's kind of like, you know, I don't like to compare Joe Hill to his dad, who's Stephen King. But one thing they have in common is that you've got this really almost straightforward horror tale on the top, but every single one of those characters has got this whole history you know is in Joe Hill's head. You know that there's a whole lot more going on behind that, which obviously will play out. You can play out far more in a serialized thing than you can in a single standalone volume. But, you know, even in these first six issues, you get this sort of wealth of, you know, history that every single one of these characters have, even characters who aren't in it much. You get this idea that
And what I love is the fact that they talk about in this book the keys. And I mean, there's a big obsession about two particular keys in this book. Mm. But on the last page, when it says, you know, the end, and you turn the last page, there's the symbol in the middle, and there's like 10 keys around it. So you go, oh, we got a lot of story to tell here. You know, there's a lot more keys involved in this.
I mean, the thing is, the basic backstory is that like their father was killed in this horrible home invasion type of thing by someone whose insanity later ties in to Key House. But if you're trying to rebuild your life, and I think it says it in the introduction as well, if you're trying to rebuild your life, don't go to a place called Lovecraft.
No.
because stuff's going to happen there, you know. It is one of those really classic, it's sort of, you think it's going, okay, this is going to be a haunted house book and whatnot, but there's far more playing out.
Yeah, there's something more going on here. So in this ancestral home or key house, the way that this is told is that there are certain keys that open certain doors that do certain things. So one of the primary keys that we hear about in this story is, what's the kid's name again? Bode. Bode. Yeah. He uses the one key on this one door and instantly drops dead.
Mm.
But his ghost comes out and yes. he gets to fly around the house and do it. And as soon as he wants to, he just says, wait back up again. And he just literally pops back into his body.
Yeah.
This plays out quite a lot in the book. This is kind of like our introduction to this whole thing and what these keys can do. And it's an intriguing concept. You sit there and you kind of go, okay. And then, of course, there's the voice in the well. What is the voice in the well?
He discovers just floating around. Yeah. There's this voice in the well who's this woman in the well that he meets who claims to be, at first, be his echo and then claims to be a childhood friend of his now deceased father.
Yeah.
And you've got but the thing is, you've got these simultaneous stories going on as well. You've got the sister trying to fit in at school, which is a very natural kind of story. But then her role and what she possesses plays very much into the whole key house door concept.
And even, I mean, Joe Hill even goes so far as to build a backstory and quite an intriguing backstory for the bad guy, who is the one who killed the father and is now in jail.
And you think, okay, that's just the backstory, but then it turns out, apart from him, you know, and spoilers for a few issues in, he escapes, and him, how he comes back into the story actually ties directly into some of those haunted elements around the house. And that's something I didn't expect. I didn't expect those elements to join up, you know. And I think that's what that fascinates me about this story. It's like all these pieces that are moving around, how are they going to connect? How are they going to come together? And it is a fascinating book. I want to read the second volume immediately. Yeah. And I haven't had a chance to go into the bookstore to go and grab another copy yet. But I definitely want to go and get the second one the next time I'm in the city. Dave, we haven't heard from you. Have you read any of Joe Hill's other stuff?
No, I have bought this one called 20th Century Box,
yep.
I think it's called, or Heart-Shaped Box.
Yeah, I think it's Heart-Shaped Box.
Heart-Shaped Box, yeah. I haven't read it, though. I've been wanting to. But I've read a... I was going to swear there. I've read a heck of a lot of Stephen King.
Yeah.
Like a ton of it. So I kind of know a lot about Joe Hill just by introductions and bits and pieces here and stuff like that. But Joe Hill's a genius. Frankly, I think he's a genius. And like there is one page in this where it's a door, a wooden door, and someone's on one side of it. You flip the page and you get a reversal. That's a genius move, I think. And that's indicative of the whole book. Like,
Look, the thing is, and
he's a master. Like
the art style.
Yeah, it's all like a violin really well played.
Narrative.
You guys don't think so?
No, look,
you're looking at me like I'm weird.
No. I'm just wondering if genius might be a superlative I don't want to go to yet. I want to read more.
Like the thing is,
this kind of storytelling is deceptively simple.
Yeah.
I think. Well, and that's exactly my point.
It's like the story itself looks like, okay, on the surface, yep, it's a thriller. I'm down with it. I get it. But the fact that I'm so hungry for the next volume, and the fact that, as I said, you can tell that there's this whole world of stuff that's going on behind. Like, you know, Joe Hill's got the whole thing laid out.
Yeah.
You know, from page one. You know, the fact that that's happening is, and again, I'm not going to go so far as to say genius, but he's a very, very clever man. I'm not going to go so far as genius yet.
That's what I want to say. It's a superlative on one volume. I sit there and go, I think it's really well written. I think it's very clever. I think my original negative, I guess, was that I thought the artwork was a little bit too simplistic.
Yeah, but that's...
But halfway through the book, I was so engrossed in the book that has now become part of the book.
It's not that the artwork is simplistic. It's actually got a lot of detail and, you know, there's a lot of shade and light and color in there and it has got that gothic style down. It's just that some of the expressions I felt were a little too... cartoony almost. Like it didn't feel... I kind of wanted it to be, you know, almost this heavy gothic, you know...
It's very unique.
I almost wanted Dave McKean to, you know, to be
it's
honest.
It's a unique art
you know.
Style.
It is a unique art style. The thing is it doesn't conflict with the story at all.
No.
And
that house is so well designed.
It didn't detract from the story. I think it's probably...
I think when I first picked up the book and I hadn't read it yet, my first reaction was I flicked through the book and I went, it's got IDW coloring, right? I mean, because IDW books all tend to look the same. And I kind of went, okay, it's got kind of simplistic art. But what I'm saying is once you start reading it, the art and the words meld together to a point where you sit there and go, you're not going to... Now that I've read the first trade... I can't imagine another artist doing this.
I think why I like the art so much is because it has a very gothic feel. And I think the gothic feel is very in line with like what his influences are here. Like, yeah, the house is called Lovecraft, but there's not much in the story that is...
Well, let's be fair, the house is not called Lovecraft.
Not the house, sorry, the town.
The town is called Lovecraft.
The town's called Lovecraft, the volume's called Welcome to Lovecraft, but if you're familiar with Lovecraft mythology, there isn't that much
in this. No.
It's just like, it's a nod. It's like, hey, where it's real...
If anything, it's got a nod to The Ring.
Well, not necessarily. It's gothic horror. That's my bag.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like you've probably noticed me rambling on about Guillermo del Toro every 10 seconds. Like, this kind of stuff is where I'm at. And so I really like this.
And it's funny, actually, as you flick through this, there is a lot more detail. There's a scene here where Bodhi's standing by a waterway, and there's just so much little detail in the Gothic columns and the cobbled walls and so forth in the background. And the next scene he steps into is the well.
Mm.
And looking at that now, every creak, every bit of line on every timber of wood is etched in there.
Because the thing is that houses like this have memories.
And
they're living, breathing places.
Yeah.
And same with the people that inhabit them.
Mm. There's actually a lot more. Flicking through this on a second run, there's a lot more detail in here than I gave it credit for. And I think that's why...
There's metaphor and symbol in every panel.
Mm. There's a really great scene I really like in here where... Ty is taking a shower, and the steam is building up around him, and he almost just disappears into the panel, and then slowly, panel by panel, he disappears, and then there's he's thinking back to his sister, this is because Bodhi's floating around as a ghost, and he's seeing all these scenes, what's happening in the house, and he's thinking to the sister, and the sister's scene fades in out of the mist, the steam. And it's kind of like that kind of transition doesn't typically happen in comics. That's a cinematic transition.
That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about when I mean genius. In the term of genius, I don't prescribe it to be like, you know, the smartest person alive or the most crazy. Like I sort of mean it as like someone who thinks outside the box, that there isn't anybody else like it. And the things like this, the panel design, are so deceptive, you don't even think about it. But as Richard just did now, flicking through and noticing things, they really start to pop up like moles, you know? And that's kind of feeling this book has, that there's a lot more to it than it first thought.
No, I agree to that. You know? I think this is...
And he's never pretentious or wanky about it. Like,
not at all.
And the kind of, that's what I think really makes him something special.
It's a series that deserves second read.
Yeah. I should say, it really deserves second read. But the other thing I really loved about this was that you come in with a preconception about it. And even the book wants you to have a preconception, because it starts off with this story about, you know, the home invasion and the murder.
That's a really generic story.
And then you suddenly get more details. Each issue gives you a little bit more detail of how that scene actually played out, and why all these characters are walking around with this massive amount of guilt, you know, and what they were doing during that time. And every single one of them, what they were doing, like, you know, the sister and the youngest brother hid, you know, and she's carrying with her guilt about that hiding. Like, survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that Ty wished his father was dead the whole time. Mm. And then when he finally did die, he doesn't know what to do with it anymore. You know, and you get that through all these flashbacks, you know. The way the mother's introduced, you know, you don't actually know what her... it's not immediately obvious that she is, because of her disposition, that she's the mother of this family, you know. And then...
She's a great character.
She's an amazing character. And it looks like in the TV series, and if we've got a second, I'll play a little bit of the trailer. She was going to be played by Miranda Otto. Which I thought was a really interesting bit of casting. The TV series didn't eventuate. It was 2011, a pilot was shot, and unfortunately, unlike most pilots that were shot, I cannot find for the life of me a leaked version of this online. But there is a trailer.
It was shown at Comic-Con.
And a trailer turned up, and from all accounts, it was bang on. The tone is right. And I'll play a little bit of the trailer now just to give you an idea of the fact that they got the tone right, but I won't play the whole thing.
Welcome to Key House.
Why is it called Key House?
Oh, that's a good question. It's an old name.
The whole place is amazing. I feel like I know the house.
How long have you been here?
A long time.
I'm sure it was just an echo. There's nobody in there.
So that's just to give you a little bit of a flavor, but it looks like they've got the look and feel and design of it. The first episode was actually directed by Mark Remenek, who, if anyone is a master of the Gothic, it's
not
Mark
Remenek.
No, Mark Remenek. If you want his Gothic credentials, go and look at Nine Inch Nails' Perfect Drug video, which is the most Gothic thing that you're ever going to see.
He was going to do the Wolfman, and then
he was, So Mark Remenek is one of those people who doesn't seem to take a break. You know, this got for some reason it didn't get picked up.
Well, and I cannot remember, 2011 was a different time for comic books. If that had been put out now, they would have gone.
Well,
you know?
Now it's being made into a three-part film series.
Great.
So I think in some ways TV's loss was cinema's gain. And looks like they're giving this time. They're not going to say one movie, let's see how it goes. It looks like they're committing to three
films.
The
unfortunate thing to that is the way television is being made right now, this would actually
benefit.
Be
a better TV, yeah.
It would benefit from the length of the TV series.
Yeah, and on a non-network series.
Yeah.
Although this doesn't look like a network show. It looked, and probably maybe that's one of the reasons they didn't continue with it, would have been too expensive to make a network
TV. This needs to be made by an FX or something.
Based
like
on
that,
how do you get away with all the raw, human stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to deal with that.
It's pretty heavy. This is heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is not a book that you can just sort of read and dismiss in a day. You actually have to spend a bit of time on it. As we've all said, a second read is definitely on the cards for it.
I think when I buy the second volume, which I will be buying the second volume, I think what I'll do is I will start from one again, work my way through up until second volume. When I buy the third volume, start from one again, work my way through.
I actually think that's a perfect way of reading it.
I think it might be.
This was Joe Hill's first comic book, wasn't it? So, and it's something that he took to like a duck to water. Mm-hmm. And I think Robert Kraes writes the introduction in this and says, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he writes a film next, because he just kind of...
He's written a comic called The Cape. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
No.
Yeah,
no, so, that, I mean, that's one we'll have to do down the track. But I definitely want to... I will, like you with Scalped, I want to just go and read the rest of them now. And it's a manageable size, like Scalped.
We can go. Also, that film that's coming out made a big splash at the con, the couple Horns, the one with Daniel Radcliffe playing... That's based on a novel by Joe Hill well.
Yeah.
And so there you go.
So yeah.
So he's going to be a big name very soon, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
If he's not already.
And the thing is, and I love the fact that he's done it both within the shadow of his father, but also completely carving his own niche out.
Totally.
As well.
Well, it helps having a different last name as well. There are a lot of people who don't know Joe Hill.
Well, they.
Stephen King's son,
so. I didn't know at first. Yeah. Someone pointed it out to me.
They work together a lot. Like they help each other write their own stories, like to the point of changing the stories.
Yeah.
Like in particular, I remember 11/22/63, which is a book King wrote a few years back. The whole ending was rewritten as from a suggestion by Joe Hill, and then vice versa happened for Dr. Sleep. And so, you know, it just works that way. You know?
That's fantastic.
If you're both writers, I guess, why not?
Yeah, know? Yeah. It's like having a built-in writers group, but with like one of the most acclaimed writers
this
of
is
all
the kind
time.
Of like, we all know nepotism's crazy, right?
Yeah.
You know, but the kind of thing is like people like this, and Jason Reitman's another good example. Like,
the Whedon brothers.
Well, yeah, that too.
I mean, that's the thing.
You might get a good
I think
entry,
nepotism
you know?
Gets a bad name or a bad rap, basically, because when you think about it, yes, I understand nepotism getting a bad rap when the producer puts his daughter in a movie just because she wants to be a movie star, you know? But when you've actually got genuinely a talented family
who support each other,
why shouldn't they
the
help
Houston
each other?
And like,
the Houston
and he's not the only King either. Owen King is a writer as well.
Mm. Okay. I've never heard of Owen King.
Yeah, and Tabitha, Stephen's wife, is also a writer. So it's a whole family.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, I mean, look, I think we can highly recommend this book.
I think so. I'm not going to give it a Comics 101 yet because
I
want to read more volumes.
No, it's like, I mean, it's look, it's not essential reading in the sense, because it is a genre book.
It's not Rick Remender. So.
It was written by Rick Remender, Comics 101 straight away.
But at this point, I am going to highly recommend it. I think it is a really good read.
Yeah.
And I think the more you read it, the more you will get out of it.
The more you read. A little rainbow popped up when I said that. Look, no, it is a great example. And I hate to say it this way, but it is a great example of a genre book, because it takes an existing genre, does something different with it, but does those conventions so well that it has sort of broken them.
Can I throw one more thing in it? By the look of the cover, by the basic story content, it kind of comes across as feeling like it should be a horror thing, but it's not a scary book. You know what I mean? It's not. It's more of a creep.
It's
a creep fest.
It's,
you know,
character driven.
It's
as well.
Character driven. It's not. It's not out to shock in the sense that it's not like there's a monster. And it's like we've got a slew of horror books at the moment.
It's that psychological horror. That,
I disagree with you in a way.
Yeah. It is horror.
I don't mean to have like a huge conversation about it, but like look at The Shining though. That's a horror film.
Yeah, absolutely. But The Shining makes you crawl under your seat and makes you jump out of your chair. Right. It's basically there are shocks. Scares.
It's not that kind of.
This is not that kind of horror.
It's not splatter horror. It's not cheap. It's not cheap.
No, it's not
cheap.
I would say it's a horror though.
We're not saying it's not a horror, but it's not like that
it
cheap
is,
horror.
It is horror. Oh, okay. You know? It is a horror in the sense that Red State is a horror, which is it's not about a serial killer. It's not about zombies chewing on flesh. It's not about vampires going and biting.
Because modern horror, modern horror is often seen as like splatterfest.
Saw.
This is kind of your more psychological horror, the kind of stuff that Roman Polanski was doing.
But there's like ghosts that haunt prison.
Absolutely.
No, look, but the thing is, when you're talking about,
I'm just being difficult.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is the scary book as opposed to.
I know what you mean.
Something
psychological. But it's almost like saying using the term horror is almost like saying fiction.
I'm going to say I fall this more into a thriller category.
I think I'm going to agree with you because I think that that defines it like in a cheap way.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's more.
Yeah, that's exactly
there's
the point.
A lot
there's
more
exactly
to
the point,
okay.
Yeah.
And that's my point is the fact that with the slew of horror books that are out there at the moment, I mean, every second book is a goddamn zombie book at the moment.
Yeah. Look at Images. Every month they've announced a new horror book.
Yeah. All I'm going to say is don't dismiss this as just some sort of cheap, you know, we're going to make you scare you and blah, blah. Yeah. There is a deeper story here. This is a family. This is a family. It's got people. They are characters. There is something more substantial. And the fact is that the main character, the hero, is a kid. You know?
And the final thing I'll say is the greatest thing about this book is that we just spent about half an hour talking about it and it went by in the blink of an eye.
Absolutely.
So that is our show. We will probably return to Lock and Key at some stage in the future.
I think we may.
On this thing. Now that it's done completely, I think we'll go and read all of these books and then somewhere down the track we will do another thing where we talk about Lock and Key in its entirety. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Cool. So next week we will be talking about the greatest film ever made. No, we'll be talking, it might well be. Guardians of the Galaxy is out in cinemas
around
the world.
Way to build it up, guys.
And it deserves to be. Oh, because we're evangelists for this film, we want everyone to go and see it.
No, I'm saying for me.
So we want everyone to go and see this film. Go and see it because we'll be talking about it shortly after its worldwide release next week. Woo! So that will be episode 103. If you want to contact us, all of our stuff, all of our news stories that we mentioned on behindthepanels.net, the network for this show and our other shows, Geek Movie Club and Film Actually, which is returning this week, can be found on geekactually.com. If you want to contact us, feedback at behindthepanels.net or our Facebook page, just look for Behind the Panels, or of course on Twitter at Behind the Panels. You can find me on Twitter at DVDBits, and I write on all those places that I just mentioned.
And you can find me on Twitter at David McVeigh. You can find me on Facebook, of course, or at geekactually.com.
You can find me Twitter at Dave Longo, and maybe a Rick Remender fan site, I guess.
You'll also find you in the cinema every day for the next three months.
Yes, yeah, I think.
Watching a certain film.
I've actually booked a few screenings already.
We're all booked into one this week.
I think we might be seeing it twice in IMAX on one day.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that good, by the way.
No.
Just thought I'd watch it 100
times. You're just
times
trying to make it make money so you don't have to eat a shoe.
Yeah. I don't think I'll need to.
No. I've actually, I'm going to say on air, I don't think anyone should have to eat a shoe for loving that film.
But more on that next week, right?
More on that next week. Until then, I'm Richard Gray.
I'm Rick Remender. No, sorry. I mean David McVeigh.
Damn you, I was going to use that joke. I'm Dave Longo.
And this is Behind the Remender.
Down there.